I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Legal analysts say it may be the first time students have been criminally charged with bullying behavior, and it could change the way states deal with bullies. A Massachusetts district attorney says 9 students from the town of South Hadley taunted 15-year-old Phoebe Prince so ruthlessly she took her own life in January. Phoebe had moved to the U.S. from Ireland, and after a brief relationship with a popular senior boy, investigators say she became the victim of constant barrage of insults and threats of physical violence. The students now face charges ranging from stalking to harassment. The district attorney rebuked school administrators but said their actions were not criminally negligent. And today parents are reacting to all of this news, so let's turn to one. Mitch Brulard's daughter attends South Hadley High. She was also bullied at that school. Mitch, what's your reaction to yesterday's charges?
Well, actually, on some of the charges, I was quite surprised. Some of the perpetrators that are involved with my daughter, I think they could have been handed down a little heavier.
Well, let's understand why. And we should say that one of the students was charged separately in a case that involves your daughter. Are you able to talk about that?
What had happened is because my daughter was the victim of bullying and the administration didn't seem to be able to put an end to it, she spoke out right after hearing of Phoebe Prince's death with a local newscast. And in retaliation for that, she was assaulted verbally and physically. She was actually pushed into a locker and repeatedly hit. But this wasn't the first altercation with this individual.
Well, Mitch, for people who are saying, you know, I watch the TV show Glee and kids get pushed up against their locker and that's sort of a joke. This is not a joke, but help us understand that. How bad was the bullying?
The bullying was quite severe down there. She was assaulted, pushed into lockers or hit in the hallway, and this continued on for quite some time.
We understand in Phoebe Prince's case, students harassed her in the lunchroom in the school library while a teacher looked on, and this was on the day she died. Someone threw a canned drink at her. After her death, students posted messages taunting her on her Facebook memorial page. Massachusetts is also in the process of passing an anti-bullying law, and a lot of people are questioning whether it's tough enough, whether it, for instance, requires teachers to be trained in bullying. What would you like to see happen at the school?
I would like to empower the administration to do a better job, to do a much more thorough job, and truly hold them accountable. When my child is in their presence, I want them to ensure her safety. Her safety comes first. As well does any other child that goes in through that threshold of that door. They should be ensured a safe and fair education.
Well, the students have now been charged, and legal analysts are saying this seems to be the first time students have been charged in bullying cases. We know parents have in the past. Do you think their parents should somehow be brought into this?
Absolutely. It's very evident out there that, you know, some of these bullying incidents come right directly from their upbringing at home.
How does your daughter feel today? Does she feel safer? Or I'm wondering, does she worry about retribution from friends of these 9 students who've been charged?
I can tell there's still a lot of concern there. She's isolated herself. She has a few good friends down there, and she keeps to herself. The concern is still there. The concern is still there. So the charges that were handed down to these kids, I think, need to be firm. We need to make a statement at this point that we're not going to tolerate what's going on.
Some people might say, you know, they could face jail time. Okay, what they did allegedly was wrong, but jail time for what goes on in a lot of high schools, it's too tough.
Well, I understand that jail time is tough, but for the years of abuse that they've handed out and for the severity of what's gone on so far, I think a little bit of jail time is warranted. They need to understand that these actions are well above and beyond what society will accept at this point.
Mitch Brulard of South Hadley, Massachusetts, where 9 students now face criminal charges related to harassment that allegedly pushed a 15-year-old to commit suicide. Mitch, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Recently, the Federation of American Women's Clubs Overseas, or FALCO, held its annual convention here in Boston. Falco is a resource for American women living abroad, many of whom have followed their husbands to jobs in business or government and find themselves without work visas. Falco offers them avenues for philanthropic work and a way to foster international goodwill. But it's not just some big international coffee clutch. The group confronts serious issues. I met two women in particular at the convention. One escaped domestic violence, one escaped Al-Qaeda. We want you to meet them. Let's start with Paula Lucas. She ran a seminar at the convention and began by telling how she met her first husband overseas.
The Newsweek photojournalist, British boarding school education, spoke three languages. Are you kidding me? Tall, dark, handsome, Palestinian refugee that traveled on a Lebanese travel document. My family loved him. They thought I'd found Prince Charming.
But he wasn't. Paula and her husband would move to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. He became abusive. She would ultimately found the Americans Overseas Domestic Violence Crisis Center. But we sat down to talk about the sometimes difficult to hear need for it.
As the years went by, my husband became more and more abusive. And then I had three sons when I lived overseas, and he also started abusing them.
And, you know, when you say abusive with the children, how bad was it?
It was brutal. I'll try to do it without crying. but when, like the children, let's say they were eating their dinner and they wouldn't eat their food, he would take the food and physically force it down their throats. And when they vomited, he would force them to eat their own vomit.
This is difficult for you to talk about now.
It is, you know, and it's been 11 years.
So did you get help? Did you go to the Abu Dhabi police?
In that country, it doesn't really matter what the nationality of the father is. He has the right to discipline his children in any way he sees fit. He had also become a naturalized U.S. citizen. We were American citizens over there, so I thought I could come home anytime I wanted.
And why couldn't you just leave?
He had hidden the children's American passports, and the embassies cannot issue passports to minor American children without the approval of both parents. Finally, after I'd been there for several years, I told my family, and they contacted, you know, the State Department. I contacted the embassy. They also contacted their senators and their congresspeople. They said they would love to help me, but that they would cause an international incident.
So you're caught. You were trapped.
Completely trapped.
How did you get out?
I think it was a divine intervention. My ex-husband was traveling in Germany, and he was robbed. A thief took his briefcase and his Palestinian travel document. Now, once he got his American citizenship, he should have given up his Palestinian travel document issued to Palestinian refugees by the Lebanese government, but he didn't. And he still had his residency for the United Arab Emirates on the Palestinian travel document that got stolen. So he was actually locked out of the country now for about a month. So I went back and I completely went through everything and finally found the children's passports. But I didn't have any access to my own money, so I had to forge a check with his name on it and took $5,000 out of the bank. And then I forged papers giving me permission to leave the country because I didn't know if he had a travel ban on the children.
How often do you think this happens? How often do you think American women are literally trapped abroad in violent situations?
Well, right now I run an international toll-free hotline to serve American women and children in foreign countries. And last year we had just under 1,500 calls, and we served just under 300 families. And we've already seen this February, we looked at last February statistics, and our crisis calls are up 330%.
What are people saying?
There's so many women that are trapped, and it's not just in the Middle Eastern countries, but in Europe, in South America, in the Far East. They marry a foreigner or an American man, and they go overseas, and they don't realize how difficult it is to get back, especially when you have children.
And you don't have control of your own passport.
Typically, in an abusive situation, the abuser hides the children's American passports.
This must be mind-boggling to many of these women, maybe even to you. I mean, American women are strong. I mean, do you find women also saying, I can't believe I'm in this? Did you feel that way, too? I can't believe this is happening.
Absolutely. Before I went overseas, my older brother asked me, Paula, why do you want to leave? And I said, I can always come home. I'm American. So you have the perception that your freedoms travel with you, and they don't. The State Department has to be concerned about diplomatic relations. We don't have to be concerned about diplomatic relations.
Tell us some of the stories that you hear, I mean, to the extent that you feel you can share them.
It's American women meeting foreign men on the internet, and then
having... You just rolled your eyes. Does that happen a lot?
Well, it's just they're young women. They're like, you know, 19, 20 years old, and they fall in love with somebody over the internet, and then these relationships tend to move very quickly. Another thing we're seeing is maybe families from Iran or Iraq or Israel who have come to the United States and raised their daughters in American society, and they have American passports. But then they send the daughters back home when they turn 18 for a vacation, but they've really arranged a marriage. She risks, you know, shaming the family or maybe even an honor killing.
So what are you going to say to this large group of women that is part of this overseas community?
Well, we just want to let them know that we're available. We have advocates and case managers that can try to help them. We're not always successful. We're relocating about one family a month back to the United States out of the hundreds that call us every year because it's so complicated to get them out. Even in Europe, people think, well, Europe's not a problem, but there's the Hague Convention on International Child Abduction. So if an American woman flees domestic violence and comes back to the United States, she can get international kidnapping charges filed against her and the children can be sent back to the foreign country. A lot of the shelters, they don't speak English. She can be undocumented. Just as we have immigrant women in the United States, American women in foreign countries may go over there on a visit visa for 6 months and then be there for 5 or 6 years, but their status was never legalized, so they can't access the local resources. It's like it is in the United States. A woman, if she leaves, how is she going to support herself financially? So that's a problem too. It's the financial aspect. She's living overseas. She doesn't have access to her own money. She doesn't speak the foreign language. She doesn't, you know, have a support network. She doesn't have anybody to talk to. And especially if he works, you know, if the husband is abusive and he works for the embassy, very difficult for her. Who's she going to turn to? She doesn't know who she can speak to and who she can trust. And I find a lot of the women that we help, you know, they are well educated and they've, you know, been to university and they worked in the United States and they've had jobs and they can't believe that they're in the situations that they're in.
How are your kids doing now?
You know, they're doing good. I think recovery from child abuse is not linear. I think there's times when they do really well and other times when they have to go back into counseling.
And where is your ex-husband?
He's still living in Dubai. I've heard that fairly soon after I left, he was bringing different Russian women over, and he eventually married a Russian woman much younger than him and started having more children.
Do you worry?
I do. I've had to separate myself emotionally from that.
But I can see you're not.
Well, I try.
We should say that you've remarried.
I have remarried, and I remarried another Arab man. I remarried a Lebanese man, and he's absolutely wonderful, and we're very happy.
Thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Robin.
At the recent convention here in Boston of FALCO, the Federation of American Women's Clubs Overseas, it was hard not to notice the diminutive woman with the spiky blonde crew cut and fierce blue eyes as she received hugs in the halls.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you to the airport. Oh, no, sorry.
Diane Reed is a former president of the FALCO chapter in Saudi Arabia. In fact, on May 29, 2004, the day she was shot by Al-Qaeda terrorists, she was preparing for a meeting of FALCO members to talk about security. And this is one of the few times she's told the story. It begins in the gated residential complex where Diane lived with other Westerners in Khobar, Saudi Arabia. Her husband worked in a desalination plant. She was an army brat, accustomed to living around the world. She felt safe.
9/11 had occurred, and we had a lot of people, the Saudis that worked with my husband, that were really quite apologetic. We felt safe.
What happened that day?
I went to the gym and worked out, and then my day was never going to be the same after that. Our compound was then invaded by 4 terrorists, and there was a lot of, and even talking to you now, you know, I have that sense of disconnection in a way because things were so crazy. I remember them like it was yesterday. But the one thing that I don't think I'll ever forget is kind of the mass hysteria. We had no communication about what was going on.
What did you actually start to see when the attack happened?
Well, a girlfriend of mine that lived on the compound called me, and she said, there's been a shooting. The terrorists actually began outside of our compound. A British man, Michael Hamilton, was shot and dragged, and a good friend of mine was shot and killed. they were looking for Americans. And from what I understand from some good sources is that a back gate in our compound didn't have anyone guarding that. And so they basically came in dressed in military uniform. I, of course, hung the phone up, and then I called my husband, and my husband was calling a friend of ours who was at the consulate, and I hung up with him, and I could hear shots. I actually looked at my cat. The cat looked at me, and it was that sense of, you know, that something is very imminent. I walked down the steps, and the front door was on fire, and I noticed that there was a bullet hole in my dining room, and then I knew that there was something somebody wanted in my house, and I could hear them kicking the door down, and that's when a voice just told me to get out of the house. And I called my husband in the office, and I said, "They're here." And he said, "Well, honey," he said, "use your gut." My gut told me to get out of the house, so I opened the garden gate, and I knew I had to make a run for it, because we also at the compound had a daycare. And, you know, I was thinking about everybody else. So I took off for the security guard house, and I looked back, and it was like G.I. Jane. I mean, he started shooting, and it was an AK-47. And I was dodging bullets. And I didn't even feel when I was first shot, but the second time I was shot was in my calf. And I was almost where I needed to be. But I remember falling down and looking back at this kid who was probably not over 20. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm too busy for this. And I remember yelling at him and saying, "You idiot. I can't believe you just shot me."
You said that to him?
I said that. I think in my heart of hearts, I thought, I mean, he may think he controls me having a gun, but if I'm going to die today, I'm going to do it on my terms. I put my head down, and I looked up, and he was gone.
How many people died that day?
The published account is 22 people. So there were two of us that survived the gunshot wounds. I shouldn't have my leg, basically.
Well, you shouldn't be alive, which is why a couple of things are pretty miraculous. One is that you got back on your feet, multiple surgeries. You ran a marathon in Dubai. That's the other miracle. That did you still continue living abroad?
We did. We thought, you know what? We're not going to be told when we're going to leave. You know, you're going to navigate through uncharted waters, and you have your friends beside you and people that are praying for you.
Well, I wonder, part of it obviously is Falco. Well, you also mentioned that your dad was a military man.
Well, you know, I'm the oldest of three girls, and I respect him so much, and he's shown me a lot about respecting others and respecting yourself and the faith he's had. I remember having come out of intensive care, and Owen had the phone right up next to my ear, and my father said, "You know, I'm so proud of you. You did everything right."
You were in combat.
When I came home, he gave me one of the medals he had earned, his Legion of Merit award, and said, "You know, you're pretty much a hero for us, and that means a lot." I didn't want, I guess, an ordinary life. And I guess it's astounding in some ways to me that not many Americans have passports. I want to encourage people. It's the hardest thing in some ways, but it's the most rewarding, because I think you grow when you get out of that comfort zone of what is normal for you, and you spread your wings, and you're overseas. You learn so much about yourself and about the world. There was a man that worked on a committee with my husband, I remember, and he came in to talk to me. He said to my husband, "I wish that people could talk to your wife, because we wouldn't be having these problems." Why wasn't I angry? You know, why wasn't I resentful about being shot by this terrorist? And my response was, well, he was somebody's son. I hope I am a good ambassador for my country, because I am proud that I'm an American. But I also want to be the kind of person that other people in other countries want to get to know.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Anybody have anything they want to say?
Yeah. Let's win this one for all the small schools who never had a chance to get here.
A Milan High School basketball player encouraging his team in the 1986 film Hoosiers, the story of the real Indiana high school team from the tiny town that surprised everyone with a 1954 state championship win. Every year in the NCAA tournament, the question is raised, who will metaphorically be Milan this time around? Well, Butler University isn't exactly a small school that never had a chance to get here, but they are headed to the Final Four for the first time in school history, playing Michigan State in the semifinals on Saturday. The Michigan State Spartans, led by Raymar Morgan, have been there before, as has Duke, led by star guard John Shire, and West Virginia, led by Deshaun Butler. But today, Butler, the college. Emily Newell is sports editor for the Butler Collegian. So, Emily, everybody's making the comparisons, but you're not exactly Milan.
We are a smaller school, but it's not like we were the underdog like Milan was. Everyone on campus knew from the beginning of the year that we were going to be a great team. We had no seniors graduating last year, so we came in ranked 10th in the preseason and finished the season ranked 12th in the polls. So we definitely knew that we had a chance. Maybe not necessarily go this far, but we knew we were a good team.
And what was it like when Butler beat Kansas State in the regional final on Saturday?
Oh, my gosh. When Butler beat Kansas State, it was just insanity broke out on campus. Everyone just left wherever they were watching the games. People were just in the streets. They closed off the main street through campus, and they were playing music, and people were dancing and singing and celebrating with each other. Everyone was just so excited that we had the chance to come back home to Indy with a win and keep playing here.
Well, Emily, I'm going to ask you now to be what you are, sports editor there for the Butler University newspaper, and give us some sense of what's ahead. Who should we be looking for in the Butler-Michigan State matchup?
I think the keys to the game are going to be keeping Matt Howard out of foul trouble, and if Sheldon Matt can shoot from outside like he has been, him and Gordon Hayward can combine.
Who have you got your eye on from Michigan State? Who does Butler have to watch out for?
We're a great defensive team, but Michigan State has played some of their best games when they're forced to adjust. They're really great at breaking strong defenses. If they can get us down low, it'll be a real close game.
What about you got top seed Duke and number 2 West Virginia duking it out?
I'm rooting for West Virginia. I think they're a great team, and I think they have a chance to take down Duke. I know Duke is a perennial pretty good team, but they're coming out of a less strong ACC compared to other years, and West Virginia just really came out of the Big East tournament, and they looked like they were playing really well all through the tournament.
And so you want to see Butler face West Virginia?
I think that'd be a great matchup. I'd really like to see it. And after taking down number 1 seed Syracuse and then number 2 seed Kansas State, I think the mindset of the entire university and of the team is there's no one that can stand in their way. They've proven that they can beat anyone.
Well, and as we said, Butler isn't exactly, you know, Milan High School from the Hoosiers film, but still a far smaller school than Michigan State with tens of thousands of students. What is Butler's secret for such a strong program?
I think because we don't have that one-star player. We do have Gordon Hayward is really good. Matt Howard has gotten a lot of national attention. But there's some guys down there like Ron Nord who plays excellent defense every game all through the tournament that, I mean, no one's heard of. We just, whenever someone is in trouble, someone else can step up and fill that spot, which is really great when you don't have one player you're relying on to get all your points. I mean, we consistently have Sheldon Mack, Ron Norris, Willie Beasley, Gordon Hayward, and Matt Howard all can score 20 points in a game.
Yeah, but Michigan State has Raymar Morgan.
I know. And hearing names like that that you always hear in the national spotlight makes you look for a second and wonder, oh my gosh, can they do it? But just because we're not necessarily in the national spotlight doesn't mean we don't have the guys that are just as good to compete with them.
That's Emily Newell. She's sports editor for Butler University's newspaper, The Collegian. The Bulldogs play Michigan State in the Final Four this Saturday. And as we said, top seed Duke goes up against number 2 West Virginia. Emily, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
All right, thanks so much.
Okay, just ahead, not to be a party pooper here, but 115 students die every year playing sports. Electrocardiograms for student athletes are a given in Europe, so why aren't more American athletes getting them? We'll tackle that in 30 seconds, here and now. Every Every year, about 115 high school and college-age students die suddenly while playing their sport, and the cause is almost always undiagnosed heart disease. Well, now, a new study by researchers at Harvard University and Massachusetts General Hospital shows that a non-invasive screening test, the electrocardiogram, can find twice as many students with hidden heart conditions than just a physical, and in turn can save lives. While ECGs are mandatory for all athletes in many European countries, the idea is a controversial one here. Many schools say they just can't afford it. Aaron Bagish is a cardiologist at Mass General Hospital, the lead author of the new study. So, Dr. Bagish, tell us first, how is your study different than ones that have preceded it?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Robin. The thing that makes this study unique is it's really the first time that anyone's looked at this issue in a prospective fashion, meaning starting with a group of athletes, exposing them to two different types of screening techniques, and really comparing how the screening techniques perform head-to-head.
And I understand this was an incoming class at Harvard?
This was three sequential years of incoming students at Harvard University.
From 2006 to 2008, there were 510 of them. How did the test proceed?
Basically, the way it worked is the kids came in, they got their routine history and physicals. They then had an ECG, which was done in a blinded fashion so that the people doing the physicals couldn't see the ECGs. And then after that was all said and done, at the very same time, we did the echocardiograms, which again are the ultrasound tests. So we had two ways of screening them, the history and physical, and then the ECG, and we had a gold standard or a backup, if you will, which was the echocardiogram.
So electrocardiograms and echocardiograms. And what did you discover? How did the ECG and the echocardiogram compare to the physical test?
Well, the ECG improved our yield by twofold, meaning we picked up twice as many young individuals with underlying heart conditions. And importantly, we picked up the type of heart conditions that are most often associated with catastrophic events. Many of these were missed by history and physical alone.
So when you say you improved the yield, you had five more young people out of, you know, again, 510, just around 10 total that you found with heart problems. That's not insignificant.
It's not insignificant, and I'll also point out that this is a group of individuals, many of whom had health care for some period of time before this. So if you envision screening people that are even at a younger age that are just coming into the healthcare environment, one would expect that the yield would be even higher.
Well, Stanford University did a study, and it showed that they could tack on an ECG test to the traditional physical for only about $89 per athlete. The American Heart Association's study concluded it would cost about $2 billion annually to screen and evaluate using these tests with the 10 million kids who compete in high school and middle school sports. And some people say that that's too much. Dr. Barry Marin at the Minneapolis Heart Institute Foundation says, you know, large-scale testing is still too costly and not feasible. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are there's a big difference between mandating something at a public health level and defining what the best practice of care is. I agree in full with Dr. Marin's conclusion that introducing a mandatory ECG-based screening is not feasible with our healthcare system as it currently stands. The goal of our study wasn't to change public health policy. It was simply to define the single best way to screen young athletes. And the major difference between public policy and selective screening is that we have an opportunity to help people that are already doing screening figure out how they may improve their services. And hopefully, as technology advances and things like the 12-lead electrocardiogram become easier to do in the community and less expensive, we'll find that these cost figures shift in favor of doing this on a more wide-scale basis.
Well, in fact, as we said, they do it all across Europe, but there it's partly subsidized by the government.
It's largely subsidized by the government, and they've actually gone as far as to make this law in certain countries like Italy. You know, a lot of this has to do with the fact that different people in different places have different priorities, and right now our healthcare system is not prioritizing this, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. However, if we're talking about saving young lives, this is certainly something to consider.
Well, and tell us a little bit more about how this issue got pretty heated in Italy in particular.
Well, the issue is that the Italians have been mandating this by law, by a decree from the government since 1981, and they've been screening young athletes as part of a nationally overseen program since that time. In 2006, they reported about 20 years of data from one region in Italy, making the claim that their ECG-based screening program markedly reduced the incidence of sudden death in their athletes and really fueled the fire. The difficulty with respect to interpreting that data is it was observational, meaning they weren't really studying it. They were simply reporting their experience. And so the ability to take their findings and to transfer them to the United States really wasn't possible at that point.
Well, now Harvard has made the decision to add the ECG to their physical exams of incoming athletes. Stanford feels that the cost of $89 per athlete is something that they can handle to do the same thing. Other schools might do this, but what should parents do? You're a doctor, but as a parent, what would you do? If you can go through your doctor, can you get one of these, and should you?
Well, as a doctor and also as a parent, I feel very strongly that the number one message to get across is to encourage parents and children to speak to their primary doctors about sport participation. And I think at this point it needs to be left up to the individual doctors how they prefer to screen athletes. But the number one thing is that some sort of screening needs to be done. Something is better than nothing. I think it's reasonable to consider the addition of a 12-lead electrocardiogram. But at this point, I think the most important message to get across is that parents and children should be speaking with their doctors, their coaches, their school administrators about whether or not screening has been performed.
Well, and if your doctor prescribes a screening for your child, does insurance cover it?
Typically, it is covered because it's part of an annual well check for a young individual. Whether or not the 12-lead electrocardiogram is covered varies from individual insurance provider to the next.
And doctor, you know, if you have a 15-year-old nephew who's playing football, is there any other way of knowing if a healthy young athlete has a heart problem that might suddenly, like that, kill them?
There is no perfect way. The most important thing is to have a heightened awareness, and what that means is knowing your nephew's family history. Has anyone else in the family had a heart problem? Has anyone else died at a young age? And knowing a little bit about this person. Are they able to perform their athletic activities without having symptoms or without having problems?
But we understand that most of the time, these things that you look for with the electrocardiogram come out of the blue.
They do, and that's the strongest argument for using the electrocardiogram, is that even when screening is done impeccably following the history and physical guidelines, things can be missed.
Dr. Aaron Bagish, cardiologist at Mass General Hospital here in Boston, lead author of a new study about cardiovascular screening for student athletes. Dr. Bagish, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Have you ever wondered where the Wizard of Oz came from? I don't mean the movie. I mean the wizard. What's his story?
I'm an old Kansas man myself, born and bred in the heart of the Western wilderness. Premier balloonist par excellence to the Miracle Wonderland Carnival Company, until one day, while performing spectacular feats of stratospheric skill never before attempted by civilized man, an unfortunate phenomena occurred. The balloon failed to return to the fair.
And that's just about all we learn from the film. But if you read the Oz books by L. Frank Baum, you know the wizard was actually a circus magician and ventriloquist from Omaha, Nebraska. And his name, Oz, is short for Oscar Zoroaster Phadrick Isaac Norman Henkel Emanuel Ambroise Diggs. Do we need to know all that? Well, someone in Hollywood thinks so. A prequel to The Wizard of Oz is now in the works. It tells all about the man behind the curtain. Another Oz project on deck is a non-musical telling of Baum's original book. And even a third is a modern-day tale about Dorothy's granddaughter going back to the Emerald City to fight evil. It's the age of the reboot, Alice in Wonderland, TV shows, comic books brought to the big screen, and how many times can Pride and Prejudice be remade? Joining us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles is Steve Zaitchik. He writes about Hollywood for the LA Times. And Steve, what's the thinking behind the Oz projects, all the remakes?
Well, you know, it's interesting about what's happening in Hollywood right now. As you say, there are so many remakes going on, and particularly with Alice in Wonderland doing as well as it has, all three of these projects suddenly have new momentum. One of them, in fact, comes from the Alice in Wonderland producer, Joe Roth. It's also set up at Disney. And so I think what studios are looking for are sort of these time-tested properties, or what they like to call low-risk properties. Of course, something of a joke there. Nothing is really low-risk. But I think when they look at Wizard of Oz and they see how many people over the years and over the generations have embraced this, they see what in their mind is a slam dunk.
Well, and the proposals aren't outright remakes, you know, carbon copies. They're, you know, more like reboots. Even The Wiz was African-American themed, so it was different. But still, does anyone express hesitation about getting involved with them because they're so iconic?
Yeah, a few of the producers have said exactly that, that, you know, they've tried to get some directors involved. And, well, you know, on some properties, Star Trek being one example, you have so many kind of younger filmmakers who grew up, and even older filmmakers who grew up with the property and grew up with various incarnations of it. They just are chomping at the bit to get their hands on it. But I think with Wizard of Oz, it's such an iconic property, and I think so many people hold it so close to their heart that they don't necessarily want to take a stab at remaking it. And if you're a studio, there's, you know, dollar signs and a lot of sort of green in their eyes. But if you're a director, all you can really do is screw up. If you do it well, if you do something interesting, I mean, you look at Wicked on Broadway, sure, you get some accolades. But if you don't do it well, the downside is so great, both to your reputation and perhaps even your earning power. I think there's going to be a lot of difficulty in kind of moving these things forward. As much as studios like the idea, I think there are filmmakers and sort of individual personalities and egos who are a lot more hesitant.
Well, and then there's always the chance that the public could turn on you, which sort of happened in our office when we started seeing some of the things that were being remade. Arthur, the Dudley Moore film, 1981, he plays the drunken millionaire playboy trying to get out of an arranged marriage with a wealthy heiress. Let's remind ourselves.
A real woman could stop you from drinking.
You have to be a real big woman.
Arthur, will you take my hand?
That would leave you with one. Sorry, here's the hand.
I love you, Arthur.
Good. I have to talk to the waiter now. My doctor has advised me that I must drink 10 of these an hour.
I understand, Mr. Bach.
We're laughing, even though we're listening to alcoholism. But it's because of Dudley Moore. Really, someone wants to do it without him?
Well, that's what's funny now is that, you know, there's all these built-in brand names, as Hollywood likes to say, or we like to say, movies that we liked when we were younger, and characters and actors that inhabited those films. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, Hollywood is very excited to sort of bring these back and say, you know, look, here's what we can do. You know, we could take the story and interpret it for a new era, and we could take Russell Brand, who is attached to play the Dudley Moore character, the title character in the new version, put his own spin, a more modern comedic spin on it. There's always people who say, well, look at the take. You know, they've got an interesting take. They've got a new take. But if the take was that new or that original, why wouldn't they just write a new script? Now, of course, a lot of screenwriters are writing new scripts. They're just not getting bought. And studios, again, in the very sort of corporatized world that they now occupy, and, you know, with box office being kind of a winner-take-all game where, you know, movies like Avatar and Alice in Wonderland really soar and much smaller films don't do well at all. There's really no middle anymore. And I think a lot of what's driving this remake phenomenon are studios saying, you know what? Yes, effort is nice. Originality is nice, but risk-taking is not so nice.
All right, well, we're going to play a clip from another classic and see if you remember this one.
I mean to kill you in 1 minute, Ned, or see you hanged in Fort Smith at Judge Barker's convenience. Which will it be?
I call that bold talk for a one-eyed fat man.
Fill your hand, you son of a bitch!
Steve, take it away. Actor, film?
A True Grit. John Wayne?
Yeah, as Marshall Rooster Cogburn, 1969 film. But as much as you might have loved that, you know, it does sound kind of interesting that the Coen brothers may remake this.
What's happening now with some of these classic properties, I think, is that when it really seems to be conceived with a certain amount of thoughtfulness or even kind of auteur vision, as we have with this True Grit remake, of course, the film, a very classic kind of post-Western film, and you've got, you know, Jeff Bridges, the Oscar-winning Jeff Bridges, and the Coen brothers, of course, Oscar winners and multiple Oscar nominees. Josh Brolin is also in the film. You're saying, you know what? Yes, maybe the world doesn't need one. We could have allowed the original to live in our consciousness, but you know what? I'd want to see what the Coen brothers are doing. Yes, it's a bit of creative vanity on their part, but it's not cold, cynical marketing calculation. If it works, I think people will embrace it. If it doesn't, like anything else, they'll shun it. But at least there's something a little bit more noble or a little bit more honorable about the whole enterprise.
Okay, here's some others. Michael Bay is working on another Rosemary's Baby. Karate Kid with Jackie Chan as the lead character. Will Smith's young boy is the Karate Kid. Fletch, Alien, Romancing the Stone. These are all films that are being remade or rebooted. Footloose. Now, I have to say, everyone's saying, no, you can't do that without Kevin Bacon. Please forgive me, but I'm saying you can't do it without my brother Jimmy, who plays the bad guy in that game of chicken on the tractors. But really, Footloose? I mean, for a generation, it meant so much.
Yeah, you know, what's funny about Footloose is Hollywood is remaking that film now when, in fact, they never really stopped remaking it. You know, you look at the franchise like High School Musical or even the Hannah Montana series on TV. They're all kind of these sort of spiritual descendants of Footloose, you know, kind of high school kids dancing, you know, the jock and the – you might as well just take the original's name and slap it on it. I mean, you're not really doing anything different. That said, I think for those of us who did grow up with Footloose, as kind of silly and as cheesy as it was, to remember, you know, Let's Hear It for the Boy and Kevin Bacon kind of dancing his way through those small town school hallways, you kind of have to say, why can't you just make another high school dance movie? Why do you have to call it Footloose and kind of reach into our consciousness and rummage around like that? You know, you mentioned Karate Kid. To me, that's one of the more cynical efforts that Hollywood is putting forth, starting with the fact that it's set in China, of course, because that's a big burgeoning market, and they don't even practice karate there. They practice kung fu. And Will Smith's young son and Jackie Chan are both learning kung fu, not karate. Of course, if you call it the Kung Fu Kid, you won't play off the nostalgia of the rest of us and get us to come out and see it. So I think there's kind of this spectrum. Everything from the really interesting and noble and kind of cool to the really cynical and sort of retread type project. And we're going to see them all over the coming months.
Steve Zajcik, he writes about Hollywood for the LA Times. He's speaking to us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles about all the reboots, the remakes of classic films. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It was great being here.
Oh, maybe he's the Romeo, but he's my